I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. Coming up on today's show, we'll hear from comedian Mike Birbiglia. He joined us back in 2008 when he was on his Sleepwalk With Me comedy tour. He's got a new movie called Don't Think Twice about being part of a comedy improv group. Then, because it's U.S. Open time, we'll listen back to my interview with tennis legend Billie Jean King. But first, tap dancer and choreographer Michelle Dorrance. She joined us last year after receiving a MacArthur Genius Award, and she did some tap dancing for us. She's amazing. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us today. We begin the show by revisiting my conversation with tap dancing virtuoso Michelle Dorrance. She joined us last year after she received a MacArthur grant. The foundation said they awarded the prestigious prize to Dorrance for, quote, breathing new life into a uniquely American art form. She joined us to discuss how she became a dancer, her approach to dancing, and she even gave us a demonstration by bringing her tap shoes to the studio. Let's take a listen. What is it that you bring to tap dance that you think is uniquely your own?
Oh, that's always really hard to answer.
I know. I'm sorry.
Well, no, I mean, I think what I can say is that I feel like I'm from a generation that got to learn from so many different masters and stylists that, you know, and I think really Savion Glover is the big example of the, you know, young prodigy who all of this information and art and history was poured into. And really was a revolutionary, both rhythmically and technically. So that I am also a student of his and a student of these, you know, incredible masters, like basically our ancestors while they were still alive, lends us to explore a lot of different directions at once, or allows those things to sort of form and, you know, for us to embody both the history and these innovations and explorations that were happening on a micro level. So I think that moving into the form now, there's so many possibilities. We want to do everything at once, like all the time.
Well, when I think of, even when you go back to the, you know, to the olden days of the 20th century, you think of solo dancers or perhaps dancing in duo.
Right.
What I hear, and actually I want to play just a clip from A Shared Evening. This is an excerpt of something you did, a Dance Space Project 2011. So it goes back a couple of years, but this is a group of people dancing together, dancing your choreography.
Yeah.
Let's give that a listen, and then we'll talk some more. An excerpt from A Shared Evening, Dance Space Project 2011. What's great is tap works on the radio really well.
I love it.
I mean,
but it's one of the great things about the form. And I think what the reason most of us, or a large number of us, are drawn to it is that you're making music through your dance. So I love listening to it. I mean, when you're watching dance, there's so much that you experience visually that you're not necessarily focused on the sophistication or nuance or tone or syncopation or some of, you know, those elements inside of the sound. But it's funny listening to that. I haven't given it that much attention every time I've watched that clip. I'm watching it as well. But isolating just the aural experience allows me to adjust. I'm like, oh.
We've got a small stage set up thanks to Stage Step. I'm going to toss it over to you, Michelle.
All right. Well, one thing I'd like to sort of talk about inside of this little moment
is
kind of creating a groove in different time signatures. So one that I just heard inside of that I love, we're performing that this week. So if I'm counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, 1. It's kind of hard to count and do it at the same time. But so this can be repeated
And I can... Yeah, a little messed up at the end. But so, like, we can create a groove and then come have a break come out of it. This is one of the things that we do often when we're working in any kind of repetitive rhythmic pattern, that kind of thing. And then at the very end, you heard something that we do quite a bit, which is a roll. So we have some of the same language as drummers when we talk about our... Yeah, so this idea, two different tones, a toe and a heel, literally toe, heel, toe, heel, toe, heel. That's our double stroke roll. So if I want to roll this a little faster. Continue all the way to. And a man who really developed a lot of rudiments that are similar to drum rudiments is a man named Steve Kondos, who is from Philadelphia.
You go. That's terrific.
Well known as a part of the Kondos brothers. So I mentioned Steve in part because there's a legacy in a lot of different major metropolitan areas of that. But he was the guy who literally developed a lot of tap rudiments mm-hmm. as drum rudiments. So another roll I'll demonstrate for you, our four-count roll that we call paddle and roll. So what you heard there was... But you can use different parts of the paddle and roll as your downbeat.
Oh, wow.
Or... And each one, because of the tone, sounds a little bit different.
How important are heels?
Oh, if we're going to, this is a good lead into this next segment. I love using my heel. Like, I maybe overuse it because it's the bass, it's the lowest sound, except for like a toe knock. But this is, if I'm going to use a heel in the paddle and roll I just showed you, I can use it lightly or. Like that idea, it's an incredible counterpoint, and that using that low range against a much higher mid or treble sound, I love that. I love that counterpoint. I love the tonal range inside of it.
And do you think of yourself as a storyteller? I mean, you're a tap dancer, you're a choreographer. Mm. Are you also a storyteller?
Yeah, I mean, I think the form itself is such a storyteller. That we, you know, we really in executing the form, we stand on the backs of those who. You know, sacrificed and innovated and pushed through racial barriers and pushed through economic barriers. And also, you know, the form fights the art versus entertainment, problem. And there, you know, so many folks who sacrificed and pushed and were never credited are also then mocked or you know, there's, I don't know, I feel like there's a long overdue respect that needs to be given to the form.
But I'm intrigued. This I guess struggle that tap dancers have.
Yeah.
Is it entertainment? I mean, we do associate
right.
it with things. I know you've done some dancing in Las Vegas, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
And you were part of Stomp.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, not that is an art, but it's sort of finding that.
Yeah, I'm finding the art inside of the work, I think, regardless of what you're doing or what you're employed to do. But I think in exploring the form, storytelling, that's what you were talking
about.
Right. I think we are constantly telling a story in that so much of our vocabulary and style is rooted in very specific dancers through the history of tap that literally changed the technique of the form. And that is amazing. So there's a storytelling going on inside of what you choose if you're improvising or choreographing, what you're choosing, what vocabulary you choose to use. And then one of the things I'm most inspired to do with my dancers is explore their individual characters, their natural characters. Or, you know, I used to work with a dancer who was 6'8". I mean, like, my gosh, like, I just wanted to play with his body. I couldn't believe he could execute the things he could with how lanky he was. And he was an incredible technician. So, but there's that. I mean, you put a 6'8" guy with a bunch of, you know, no one's over 5'7". The juxtaposition in and of itself creates a story or creates a character. So there's, I'm constantly wanting to explore that. And then also exploring storytelling through the way different dancers execute different movement. That's always really fun for me.
And do you have a favorite move or maybe a favorite thing that you want to demo with us?
Favorite move, let me think.
And then we'll put you back in your other seat. And I know there's some folks that want to.
You know, I'll tell you this. We were talking about rolls earlier. So I'll do a 7-count roll, which is something that I'm, you know, been obsessed with for years. So if this is our 4-count roll, like I said before, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. So there's our 4. Our 7-1. And it also rolls over the phrase. So I say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2. three, four, one, two, three, four, one. Yeah. So I also love the way the different tones roll over the phrase.
And is that why you've been obsessed with that rhythm? I mean, it is.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I love it. Yeah. And you can play with different things. I could use my heel. Or. Yeah. You can. There's so much inside of it that you can play with. Yeah.
Michelle and I were talking during the break. She's going to do a little improv for us.
All right.
God, that was terrific. Thank you so much. I wish we had a gigantic auditorium here that could give you applause. And it was, I mean, from the subtlety to the really sort of in-your-face kind of performance.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a moment like this, I'm like, what am I going to do? So you just sort of follow what you're interested in rhythmically.
And you're catching your breath here.
Sorry.
I mean, this is, it's a lot of work,
it
right?
It is, but it... I don't know. It inspires and motivates itself. I think that you're moving to create music is, I don't know, it's incredibly visceral, and it's the best thing. I don't know why not everybody does it.
That was my 2015 interview with tap dancing virtuoso Michelle Dorrance. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from tennis legend Billie Jean King. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're in the midst of the U.S. Open. Will Serena Williams be able to beat Steffi Graf's record of 22 major singles titles? We'll see. Tennis has a long history of achievers both on and off the court, and Billie Jean King is one such star. She's been a staunch supporter of gender equity and for the LGBT community. King is also owner of the tennis team, the Philadelphia Freedoms, which is part of the World Team Tennis League, which she co-founded. Billie Jean King joined us in the studio a couple of years ago to talk about her life, about tennis, and her advocacy. Let's take a listen.
What do you like as a coach? I mean, how do you coach players?
What's your approach
I
to coaching?
I coach by asking a lot of questions.
Oh, interesting. Like what kinds of questions?
Why do you play tennis?
Oh.
Why do you play?
Why do I play?
Yeah, why do you play?
I play tennis because I love that feeling when I hit the ball right. My backhand is better than my forehand. When I hit the ball right, it just feels so good.
Doesn't it?
We
were just talking about that before the show. You weren't around, actually. No. We were talking with a group. And that's exactly what we were talking about. Yeah, I was. The same thing. That's the right reason I love to play. But I always ask youngsters, why do you play? Because it gives me an insight to where they're coming from. Mm. If they say right away, it's fun, it's this, then I know we're okay. If I get a child who has to think hard and long, I know there's
usually... For the right answer, perhaps?
Well, there's no right answer, but there's a feeling of they're doing it because they want to, or there's a feeling they're doing it because of somebody else. Mm-hmm. So that gets you at least understanding them very quickly, a start. Mm-hmm. And that's very important. So I ask a lot of questions. I think telling stories are fun, a way to learn. So I might tell them an old-fashioned story and say, oh, but you guys hit so much better than we do. But, you know, there's a story or some fun thing that happened. And when you have a team, funny things do happen. There's no question. Whether you have Fed Cup, Davis Cup, which are international play, Davis Cup for the men, Fed Cup for the women. And then, of course, with us, Milan World Team Tennis is it's exceptional because we have both genders, and I like that. I like both genders. If you watch a World Team Tennis match, you see my philosophy on life. It's men and women working together. Everything I do, I've been known as a women's person that fights for women's rights, but actually if they really know me well at all and know my history, I've been labeled that, but that's not who I am. I'm really for both genders. I grew up with a brother who played for the San Francisco Giants.
He's a pitcher, right?
He's a pitcher, a good slider. They're very good. Done your homework, and then he's a great guy. But I just think we're in this world together, and we need to work together. We need to – more men are in power. We need them to change because they're the decision makers. We need corporations to step up, equal pay for equal work because it takes government a lot longer to do things. I think it's up to businesses to make it right.
And we're almost up in a break here, but I guess the idea of seeing then men and women together on the court.
It's fantastic.
Working together, negotiating together.
That's fantastic. They jump up off the bench when the player – changes ends and they're in there together. It's really great. It's the way I want the world to look.
Look like a tennis court, right?
Yeah, well, now that's our stage, right?
Indeed it is. It's so interesting that you ask players, why do you play tennis?
That's usually the first question.
Yeah, which I think is a fascinating question, the more I even think about it. But having watched that American Masters piece on you, a documentary on you, it seems like for you it was a kind of love at first sight. There was something about picking up that tennis racket that seemed to just be what you wanted to be and do what you wanted to do.
Well, some of it has to go with my personality, who I am. And when I used to be in fourth grade, they give you that recess within the classroom, like for 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And you couldn't leave, but you could read or do whatever you wanted. And I'd always go up to the class at the head of the classroom where they had maps, and I'd pull down maps and I'd say, God, I want to go to China. I want to go to these places. I want to go here. I still haven't been to China. I want to go to Africa. I want to go to Europe. I want to go to Russia. I want to go to Canada. I want to go to South America. I thought, there's no way I'm going to be able to go. My dad's a firefighter and we can't afford to go any place. We're just starting, we hadn't even started to go out to eat yet. So I'm thinking that's not going to happen. And one thing I love is history. So when I started to get involved in tennis, I read right away on it. When Susan Williams, actually, who lives in Philadelphia, is Catherine Woods, her last name now. She's married and has two boys and men and a grandchild. And she buys a box, for instance, to the Freedoms every year. And I love telling the story when she's around because she's in the audience. I tell them how I got started. She asked me, Susan asked me, do you want to play tennis? And I said, what's tennis?
I had not a clue. Even though you come from a very sporty family.
I know, but we were team sports. Basketball was my first love. Baseball, my brother playing, like I said, with the Giants. And then he wanted to be a Major League Baseball player by the time he was 10. I wanted to be number one in the world in tennis at 11. And I'm almost 5 years older. Thank God there's a little bit of a gap there.
Yeah.
And so you're right, though. I absolutely loved it, but I read all the champions. I knew that they go to London for Wimbledon. I went, whoa, now we're talking traveling. See, and I memorized in those days. I had every year memorized. I looked up the U.S. Open used to be the U.S. Nationals in those days. I learned all their who won this, and I love history. I'd read about all the players. You know, I just read Alice Mar. I mean, I just loved him. I read two books over and over. I always wanted to be somebody by Althea Gibson, who was the first person of color to play. She was our Jackie Robinson in our sport, and then she went on to win major championships in her late 20s. I love that book. I always wanted to be. So I slept with that book, and then Tennis with Heart, Doris Heart, because she had a very tight, wonderful relationship with her brother. And now looking back, I understand why I love the book, because I'm very close to my brother. You know, it's just like projection. About myself. But I had those two books and my tennis racket and everything on the bed, and then I'd always read. And I love biographies. So,
But it's not like you loved hitting the tennis ball, obviously.
That's the most important thing, because I loved hitting the ball. Anything with a ball. My brother and I, our third word after mom and dad or mommy, daddy, was ball. We both would say, ball, mommy, ball, daddy, you know, like – and get all excited and ball, ball, ball. So they'd throw it on the ground. I get all excited. I get to throw it. I'm all excited. And then I'd have my dad would throw the ball and I'd hit it in the back. Well, I didn't have really a backyard, but what was it? And he would throw it, you know, he would toss it and I'd hit it and I'd hit it because I wanted a baseball bat and he wouldn't get me a baseball bat because, you know, he says, I got to see if you really like it. I said, damn, dad. So I'd go out and I'd hit and I'd hit and I'd hit. And then finally he said, okay, you've earned it. I'll go get you a bat.
But in this American Masters, when you said, you know, I want to be a tennis player, your dad said, or maybe your parents said to you, well, you have to raise the money to go buy your first racket.
I said, Dad, Mom, can we go get my first racket? And they said, no. My dad says, how much do you want it? I said, no, I really want it, Dad. He goes, show me. You know, like, show me the money.
Yeah.
He says, show me. So I went to all the neighbors. I got lucky. We had a great block of people, and nobody made very much money, but they all gave me dimes or quarter, maybe. It was a big deal. And I saved like, I don't know, it was either $8.29 or $9.28. And I'm a little dyslexic, so I don't know which one anymore. But up in the cupboard in a mason jar, I saved the money. And then I couldn't wait any longer. I was just like, Dad, Mom, can we go? So we went to Brown's Sporting Goods in Long Beach.
Got your first
wooden
racket,
he says,
right?
Wooden, of course. He goes, what do you want? And I said, what is this much money buy? And that's how he said, well, I can help you there. And of course, I chose it by color. Because it's wine or lavender, and that's my favorite color, purple.
Oh, purple racket.
Oh, yeah, purple strings, purple handle, purple throat with a little bit of white. I'm sorry I turned it in. I turned it in at the rec park where I got instruction from Clyde Walker. And they gave me they upgraded it because Clyde said, let's go get you a better racket. So they upgraded the rackets they had they gave out as rentals. And I had to put my racket in to get it. And, of course, when you're at that age, you don't think, oh, later in life you'd like to have that racket.
You know, there are many things I love about the way you play tennis, but I love the way you would hit and come to the net. I mean, you don't
Yeah, but that's surface. No, but the surface dictates that and the speed of the ball. So there's so much more power in the game.
Yes, true.
You can't chip and charge. You'll get past left, right, and center. It's not that easy anymore. So that's why we don't see it. And the strings are more important. The rackets, they're more dynamic. Their bodies, their head is still. It's like a still head because you see the ball five times better when your head's still.
Oh, interesting.
And then, but you want a very dynamic body if you look at the players today. Watch the great ones. Just watch their head, how still it is, but watch how dynamic their body is. We used to hit about like from 180 degrees, and now they go more than 360 when they hit the ball. But the way they play, I mean, they're amazing. And physically, it is so demanding. I mean, I thought it was demanding when we were playing. It's nothing compared to today.
Well, and I mean, it'd be interesting to sort of, you know, take the Billie Jean King of the 1960s and 70s and put her up against a Serena Williams and see what would happen.
No, we wouldn't do well at all. They're so much better. Now, if I could be born today, I'd be a much better player.
Right.
It's all you can do is be the best in your generation and then move on and be happy for the next generation. It's like a parent who wants their child to do better than they did. And that's basically how I always think about passing the baton to the next generation. That's why I quit at 60 being Fed Cup captain. It was time to pass the baton. People get greedy.
Yeah.
You know?
Did you enjoy your wins? I mean, you have so many.
Probably not enough.
Oh.
Because we're always having meetings off the court, always trying to change things. It was very demanding off the court. So I would say tennis was probably pretty secondary. And I didn't probably enjoy my victories enough.
And were you someone that would beat themselves up over a loss?
Just Chris Everett and I totally the same. Chris Everett and I used to talk about this all the time when we were playing. Oh my God, we get so depressed. Oh, we're like crazed. I think Steffi Graf used to go to bed for 3 days after when she had a horrible loss. Yeah, wow. We hate losing. Champions hate to lose. The pain is unbearable. It's horrible. Oh, I can't stand it.
Even to this day,
oh, I can't stand it. No, I can't. I understand. I would probably be. I know I'd be the same. I'm a perfectionist, which just can be painful. I've gotten better, not much though. Everybody around me must think, oh God, you know, we're going to have a day with her. It's going to be tough.
Well, I'm curious about even the voice in your head, whether you are berating yourself. When you were playing, are you berating yourself on the court? Or are you speaking positively to yourself?
I have two sides. I would berate myself, but in so doing, I'd think very positive thoughts. It's like I say, are you kidding? That is so bad. Or, yeah, it's a joke. And I get really tough on myself. But the other part of me would chime in like, let's go. We can do it. I can do it. I can do better. It's like, let's go. And so it actually ended up being a motivator for me. And for a lot of people, that would not be a motivator. I would say I was the one percenter.
They could sort of have both these conversations.
Yes, and my brain goes fast anyway. And so I could – I'm the kind of kid, if I change ends and you're a coach and you coach me and you can give me a textbook, the whole thing.
Yeah.
By the time I walk from the umpire's chair out to the baseline, I will have filtered what I think's important. And I love doing that. That's fine. Give me whatever you got, and then I'll figure it out.
And that's Billie Jean King, our guest in this hour of Radio Time. She's the owner of the Philadelphia Freedoms and co-founder of Milan World Team Tennis, and of course had many wins and some losses in her tennis career.
Lots of losses,
but she doesn't like to talk about
that. Okay. No, I can talk. No, the losses is fine. You learn from winning too, though. I want kids to know why they win. That's another question I ask. I want them to spend a lot more time on why they win. And I wanted them to really spend a lot more time on self-awareness and their strength and their weaknesses, and make your weaknesses adequate and keep practicing your strength. Mm. And I think people tend to think, oh, they only learn when they lose. It's not true. If you really will sit and reflect why you won is what I want you to remember, and hit the enter button. You know, our brains are like a computer. It's whatever we feed, it counts. So why did I win? You know, why am I winning? What makes me who I am? And you always want to keep your strengths, no matter what field of endeavor it is.
I was reading, I think it was 2007, Wimbledon finally gave out equal prize money.
All four majors in 07 did.
And all four majors.
Wimbledon said okay, and then 2 weeks later, the French followed suit. They were the last ones. So in 07, both of them did it, because Wimbledon announced it before the tournament, way before the tournament. And then the French were shamed into it because they're the last one left, because U.S. and Australia was already doing it. The U.S. did it, gave us equal prize money in 1973.
Really?
It took from 19... Really? Well, we started in 68, but it took from 1973, well, 68 really, but 73 was the first one, to 2007. That was a long haul, and we worked behind the scenes all the time. Venus Williams was part of that. She stepped up and went to meetings and went to the committee meeting at Wimbledon. I think she's the one that changed. Wow. Larry Scott, who was our Women's Tennis Association executive director at the time, said she changed it. She really went to this meeting and had them close their eyes and imagine.
But what a real victory. I mean, you spent many years both behind the scenes, but also...
Yeah, way behind. I mean, I was trying to push Venus forward on it. I've been always mentoring she and Serena, because they were on my Fed Cup team, like when I was the captain, the U.S. Fed Cup team. So for 6 years or so, I had time with them. They're very coachable.
Oh, interesting.
Very. Oh, no, they're fun. Of course, I met them through a World Team Tennis clinic out in California, because I'm from Long Beach, and they were living out near there
when
they were 10. And so they always remember this Team Tennis clinic, and Venus tells that story all the time. She plays for the Washington Capitals. She tells that story to the kids. I heard her, overheard. She didn't know I heard her. And she says, you know what? Milan World Team Tennis gave me an opportunity when I was a kid at a clinic with Billie Jean. And now it's my turn to give back. And so all of our teams in Milan World Team Tennis definitely do work, you know, in the community all year long. That's our job. It's not just winning championships for the city. It's to be a fabric of the community as well, and to make a difference to the community and to the future generations. And that's what we want to do with the Philadelphia Freedoms all the time. We always have a lot of freedom tournaments, leagues, all that. We're trying to get them to be exercising for the health of our nation as well. And tennis, as you know, Marty, because you're still playing, is a lifetime sport. So if I can, if we can give a child the gift of tennis, then we've done it.
How would you prepare for a game? Was there a certain way that you would physically?
Every player has their rituals. Everyone.
And what was
yours? Do you have yours?
Oh, God. I could use some rituals, actually.
Well, might help. Sameness helps.
Right. I do have a thing where I do bounce hit, because my brain is all
that
over
works.
The place.
Tennis. Yes. Tim Galway.
Yes, exactly.
I love
so
that.
I do that, just because.
That's a great one to use.
To sort of control my mind. But no, I don't have any. What were yours, though?
Actually, bounce hit works. It does work. When kids are warming up and they can't get their timing, that's the one I suggest. I said, I don't care. You figure it out, but here's a possibility. I found that I couldn't pack my bag the night before. I always forgot something. I had to do it in the morning. I was very big on, like at Wimbledon, I had to have a certain cubicle.
Oh.
They didn't have showers in those days. You know, they only had baths. So I was like, oh, yeah.
They had baths. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, God. I had to bath. And so I didn't want to go in that cubicle. I had to have the same cubicle.
Right.
1 year at Wimbledon, I ended up wearing the same dress because I felt like it was my lucky dress. Right. Poor Ted Hengley, who made my dresses, he was dying. He's like, oh, Madam Superstar. That's my nickname.
Yeah.
Madam Superstar, I've got 7 dresses for you, one each match if you win this. And I go, this is the one. I can feel it. It was the last year I played, you know, won the singles. I said, I can just feel it. He says, okay. You know, you get these little idiosyncrasies going.
We're almost out of time here. And I know it's been many, many years, or maybe not so many years, since you have competed, but do you miss that at all?
No.
Just the
Day after I retired at 40, the very next day I was in the World Team Tennis office. Well, I wasn't the next day because I was in Australia, so I had to come home first. But I was 40, and I knew exactly what I was going to do because I love team tennis for what it is. If you watch a World Team Tennis match, like I said, it's my philosophy on life.
That was my 2014 conversation with tennis legend Billie Jean King. She's the owner of the team, the Philadelphia Freedoms, part of the World Team Tennis League, which she co-founded back in 1974. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from comedian Mike Birbiglia. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks again for joining us today. Well, comedy is hard business. Many comics admit to having an intense need for attention and for laughs. Mike Birbiglia explores the mindset of a comedy improv group and the competitiveness of show business in his new movie, Don't Think Twice, which he wrote, he stars in, and directed. He'd previously dealt with his own mind with his first film, Sleepwalk With Me. It detailed some of the most extreme episodes of his real-life sleep disorders. The film drew from his one-man show of the same name. He joined us while on tour for Sleepwalk With Me a few years back to chat about comedy and his life as a sleepwalker. Let's listen. Tell us a little bit about this disorder that you have from your perspective. What is it like to be you with this disorder?
Well, it's a disorder that I'd had for many years, but I never quite dealt with. I would have these incidents like the Dustbuster Olympics, or for example,
and that's for real, right?
Oh yeah, no, and beyond real. I wish it weren't. I would have a dream, for example, where there was a hovering insect-like jackal in my bedroom, which is the scariest animal one's brain can conjure, is a jackal that defies gravity, and I would jump on the bed. I would strike a karate pose, and I would say, "There's a jackal in the room," to my girlfriend at the time, and she would say, "There's no jackal, go to bed." And I would say, "Are you sure?" She would say, "Yes, there's no jackal," and I would go to bed knowing that there was a jackal right there. And at that point, you know, and with the Dustbuster Olympics, I was thinking, you know, maybe I should see a doctor. This seems dangerous. And then I thought, maybe I'll eat dinner. And I just went with dinner. For years.
Put off seeing the doctor.
Yeah.
But from your experience and just those two vivid examples, we should say to our listeners, you're asleep at this time while all this is going
completely asleep.
On the one hand, you have these amazingly vivid dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess on the other hand, and this is part of this disorder, is you begin to act out those dreams. They seem real to you.
And the physical elements of this are that you're having a dopamine deficiency. Dopamine's the chemical that's released from your brain into your body when you fall asleep that paralyzes your body so that you don't do what's in your brain, essentially. And so if people who have this can act out their dreams, and people, in rare instances, people who have this have been known to kill the person they're in bed with while remaining asleep. So in other words, they'd have a dream that it was some kind of burglar or something, and they would take a bat, they would beat the burglar to death. They wake up, it's not the man's, it's not a burglar, it's the man's wife, and she's dead. I read this. I remember reading this because there's an excellent book called The Promise of Sleep out there, written by a guy named Dr. Dement, and it talks all about, which is a very unfortunate name for a man trying to instill calm.
Dr. Dement, yes.
He might have been opted for a pseudonym, but it's an excellent book. And I was reading that in rare instances, people are known to have to kill people in their sleep. And I read this, and I still didn't see a doctor. Because I was so busy. That was all. It's always been my excuse for whenever I don't want to deal with something in my life, I always point out how busy I am.
Well, of course.
They don't. In my mind, it makes sense. I'm like, this person doesn't realize how busy I am. If they knew, of course they wouldn't want me to see a doctor.
Well, you had mentioned something earlier. I mean, this. Have you had sleep problems your whole life, and it's sort of just sort of gravitated into this pretty serious disorder?
Yeah, I never had sleepwalking as a kid, although that's very common in children. But I always had wild dreams.
Did you?
A kid, I always had dreams that there was a bear walking in the front door of my house. That was a recurring dream of literally opening the door, which is the scariest part of bear with opposable thumbs.
Indeed.
As if a bear can open a door, sky's the limit.
Stephen Colbert would agree with
that's
you
right.
with that.
There was actually a story in the news this week about a bear that actually did open a door.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's actually the most terrifying thing one can imagine.
But that was a recurring dream that you had as a kid?
As a kid, yeah.
But you didn't sort of fight the bear or do anything like that. So this came later in life, this sort of acting out.
It happened in my early 20s. I was experiencing a tremendous amount of anxiety because I was living with my girlfriend at the time, and it became very clear that she wanted to get married. And I was 23, and I wasn't ready to get married, but I couldn't say it.
Yeah.
But I started having trouble breathing. I would have that shallow breathing, where you feel like you can't breathe, and then you feel like you're going to die because breathing is one of the building blocks of living, And I started sleepwalking, and that's when I started having these incidents.
Wow.
Yeah.
And do you still have the same girlfriend?
Nope. she met someone else. And
well, as you say, your stand-up is about a number of things, including the sleep problem that you have, but also about denial.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can all relate to some aspect of denial. But
by
at some
means.
Point, you did seek therapy. I mean, you read this book by Dr. Dement, The Promise of Sleep, and it sounds like he told you some of the sort of basic architecture of sleep and sleep hygiene as it's described.
Yeah, there's a few basic things you can do that for healthier sleep, and this goes for people who have sleep disorders or not. I was talking to my mom about this last night. I mean, my dad was up late watching like a violent like mystery show or something, and it's actually so counterintuitive to do that. He talks about turning off the news before you go to bed, turning off your phone, turning off the internet, not having big meals, like anything that would kind of stimulate you. I mean, a few hours before bed, you should theoretically try and kind of dial down.
All right. And that's what you've learned to do.
Yeah.
Did you ever have sort of sleep phobia? I mean, sort of knowing that you could have some wild night on your hands that you sort of had that sort of phobic feeling about your bed?
Absolutely. I mean, I tour as a comedian. That's my full-time job. And so it's tough because for a while I wouldn't talk about it because I was ashamed of this kind of crazy disorder that I had. And so my agent would actually call ahead to places I was performing and say, Mike has to stay on the first floor because I'd had a dangerous incident where I actually jumped out of a window from the second floor. And inevitably they'd ask.
In your sleep, obviously.
Yeah, in my sleep. And inevitably, they'd ask why, and he'd cover for me. He'd be like, because that's what Mike Birbiglia wants, And I'd show up, and these people would kind of vaguely dislike me before I'd even met them because I had these absurd requests, and it started to feel this kind of slight distance between me and everyone that I met, and it was very, sad.
But, it's interesting, and I think a lot of comedians do this, which is to take either shameful or painful parts of their life and you know, turn them around or find the comedy in it. And I always think that there's comedy and tragedy are pretty closely aligned. There's almost like a flip side of each other.
Oh, yeah, there's a very fine line.
Depending on one's perspective, I think.
Absolutely. I think the closer you go to the truth, the closer you can get to comedy. And
that's funny.
I'm still working on that. I'm still riding that line, trying to figure out exactly where that is. But yeah, no, it's all my stories are true. I always have to preface my show by saying that because inevitably someone will come up to me after the show and they'll be like, was that true? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, was it? And I don't know how to respond to that. Like, I guess I could say it louder.
Prove it, right?
Yeah, yeah. I could be like, yeah. And they'd be like, it's probably true. He said it louder. But no, it's true. I mean, it's just one of these rare instances in your life where in retrospect you're like, what the hell? And at the time, you're like, I guess I'll continue living. I don't know. It's like if you went to the dentist and he asked you to take your pants off. And you're like, he's got a degree. I don't know. But I'm going to make a note of this because this seems crazy.
Well, let me talk a little bit about you.
Sure.
And I read that you went to Georgetown University. You studied writing there?
Yep.
And you also won the Funniest Student Award in college? The
yeah,
Funniest Person on
Campus
Award?
That's how I started being a comedian.
Is
yeah.
that right?
Yeah, I'd always wanted to be a comedian, but I've heard this a lot from people where it's a contest of some kind that kind of gets you to say, you know what, I'm going to go for that. And I won, and then I ended up working at the door of the D.C. Improv. I got to open one of the prizes was to open for Dave Chappelle at the D.C. Improv.
For Dave Chappelle?
Yeah, this is very pre his Comedy Central series fame and all that stuff, but I was a big fan of his stand-up, and so it was a big honor, and then I said I'd like to get on stage again, and they handed me a mop, and so I had a job just kind of working the door and selling tickets and doing all these kinds of things. And I actually, you know, it was kind of my education in comedy was working at this club and watching these great national headliners who would come in, you know, Brian Regan and Mitch Hedberg and Louis Black and Dave Attell and these kind of folks. And and I learned that you can make a living being a comedian.
But you have to be funny. I mean, clearly you were.
Yeah, you have to be more than funny. I mean, you have to. There's a lot of hardship. any kind of making a living being an artist, I feel like there's a lot of delusion that it has to be there where because there's a lot of failure
of course
at the outset, and you have to tell yourself it's going well when it's clearly not going well. You know, like I remember my first gig was completely based on a lie. My first paid gig, I was asked to perform 30 minutes at a place called Fat Tuesdays in Virginia, and what I should have said was I probably only have about 11 minutes prepared, and what I did say was yeah. And I show up and I'm backstage, which is just like the sidewalk of a strip mall, and I'm scared to death because I don't know what's going to happen after the 11 minutes. And they opened the
door.
You
knew you had 11, and you knew you had to fill
30. And I had no idea what was going to happen. And
so what happened?
I even said to the guy who was the headliner, I go, hey, what happens if I run out of material? And he goes, just make fun of people. I was like, I don't know if that's such a good idea. Because whenever I make fun of people, they punch me in the face. You know, I later found out that's a whole genre of
it
comedy.
Is.
You know,
that sort of hostility comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Stuff.
You know, people walk up on stage and nice shirt, loser. Everyone's like, it's so true. His shirt does suck. This guy's a genius. I'm from Jersey.
Right. Not your style, right?
It's not my forte. And but they open the door and they go, Mike, you're on. I turn around and I throw up on the sidewalk. And then, because my body couldn't come up with another plan, it was just like, what do we do? Let's get rid of some food, you know. And I walked on stage, and I heard them say, I've heard many bastardizations of my last name in my life. This is the worst I'd heard.
What was it?
Please welcome Mike Bahuski. I was like, so mad. I was like, you didn't even try. You just said B and then whatever you could think of. And I did 4 minutes of comedy, because when you're bombing, it pairs down very quickly.
You're just jettisoning things, or you're just going so fast.
Yeah,
just kind of
fast, and then basically, you know, tags of jokes fall away when the original punchline doesn't work. So the kind of the digressions and riffs go.
So what did you do
away.
For 26 minutes?
I just walked off. I said thank you, sorry. You know, I walked off. I thanked people and apologized at the same time. And then I drove home to my girlfriend at the time, and she said, "How'd it go?" And I said, "It was amazing." Because in my mind, it had been. And if it hadn't, I wouldn't have been on stage ever again. I wouldn't have done it again.
So this ability to delude oneself or be in denial,
denial,
as you say,
yeah.
But clearly you had to, figure out some stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, like any art form, it just takes a lot of trial and error. I mean, I get so many MySpace messages and Facebook messages and emails from people saying, I want to be a comedian. How do I do it? And there is no answer for that. And that's a difficult thing because there's a lot of people who want to become comedians and they're very funny. A lot of these people are the funniest people you could ever imagine. I mean, my brother Joe, who collaborates with me on a lot of writing, attempted to be a comedian early on, and he didn't enjoy the rejection or couldn't handle the rejection enough, and there's so much of it. So he just was like, oh, I'd prefer to be a writer.
But does it help? I mean, are you sticking to a script, or do you allow yourself some spontaneity?
Early on, I really stuck to a script. I mean, word for word. I mean, in shows I do now, it's, I feel more comfortable being loose about it. But yeah, I mean, there's a great interview with Jerry Seinfeld available somewhere that said, I think it's called Jerry Seinfeld on Comedy. And they ask him what advice he has for young comedians. And he says, every year there's a conference in Las Vegas where these comedians come and they do workshops and classes and all these things to find out how to become a comedian. And he said, I would cancel all of those and I would just put up a sign that says, go home and work. And it's like, that's all you can do is just work and fail and work and fail. And eventually you work and succeed.
And is it just mining your life, or are you one of those people that sort of is a sponge, when you're out in the world, you're kind of a sponge, you're hearing conversations or seeing situations?
I suppose I am, yeah. I guess that's where it comes from.
You've kept, while you've been doing this tour, you kept a kind of a journal on some of the experiences that you have, and you have a really funny description of doing the show where Chris Matthews is actually in the very front row while you're doing your comedy tour. I wonder if you could talk about that.
I actually, that wasn't on this specific tour, but I write a blog. It's called mysecretpublicjournal.com. Right. And I'm always a little embarrassed to tell people I have a blog because everyone has a blog about anything. People will be like, today I went to JCPenney, and there's like, one comment, like, JCPenney, eh? I'm like, that's not a blog. That's a text message.
Yes,
but no, I actually do spend quite a bit of time on writing my blog, and I email it to thousands of people who get it. And I think it actually, even people who sign up for it, it goes into their spam box. I found this
Such
out.
Such is the way of the internet.
I found
right?
this out because I go into my own spam box, yeah. Which is insane.
it tells us something about you. But nonetheless,
right, exactly.
Tell us this story about Chris Matthews.
No, so I was asked to do a roast of Stiller and Mira, the comedy duo, classic comedy duo, and in Nantucket. They had a Nantucket Comedy Festival, and Chris Matthews was in the front row, and I said, I love your because actually my wife and I watch his show every day, and we watch Hardball, and I said, I love your show, Chris. I love it almost as much as you do. I don't even recall what it was that I had, like, about four jokes back to back.
You said I even watch your weekend show.
Oh, I go, yeah, I even watch your weekend show on NBC that no one watches. And and he goes, people do watch that. I'll show you the numbers. And then he threw a bottle at me, and it was a plastic bottle, so it was non-threatening. But I said, Chris, when you throw stuff, I win. That's how it works. And
did you have the last laugh?
I think so. Yeah, people applauded and cheered, and but the truth is, if he had had a microphone, he actually is very funny. I had met him earlier in the day, and if he had had a microphone, he possibly. I may well have been toast.
That was my 2008 interview with comedian Mike Birbiglia. He's got a new film in theaters called Don't Think Twice, about the world of improv. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Liz Fiedler, Trine Nouri, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Artie Moskowain. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great Labor Day weekend.